of a theory of quantum gravity is one of the outstanding problems in theoretical physics. The laws of quantum mechanics and Einstein's general relativity just looks at odds with each other. They look incredibly hard to reconcile. And today some theoreticians think that we should go back to basics and rethink some of the most fundamental issues in physics, like what is motion and what is time. So let's start with Newton, which is as basic as you can get. Newton's first law, also known as the law of inertia, has an incredible reach. It has an immense predictive power. It allowed Newton to couple with, for example, the assumption that gravity is a central force. It allowed him to predict the first and second law of Kepler. And with the universal gravitation, he can predict the motion of the moon, the planets, comets, and a wealth of... Post-diction, yes. Explain. Okay. And when... So the law goes, everybody perseveres in its state of rest or of uniform motion in a right line, which is a straight line, unless it is compelled to change that state by forces impressed thereon. So as I said, this is in the Principia, the mathematical principles of natural philosophy. As I said, Newton was well aware that this law had an immense reach and could explain all sorts of observations when he came to write his Principia. But he was also aware that it disguises a problem. With respect to what are you to define rest or uniform motion and even a straight line? To address this issue, he introduced in the Principia absolute space and time. In his word, absolute true and mathematical time of itself and from its own nature flows equably without regard to anything external. And by another name, it's called duration. Absolute space in his own nature without regard to anything external remains always similar and immovable. This is his definition. And a lot of his contemporaries like Leibniz or Descartes would have immediately argued that these things are not observable. Moreover, philosophically, they are very fishy because they are things that can influence matter, but cannot be influenced by definition by it. So, and Leibniz and Descartes were advocates of relational dynamics, a dynamics in which the position of the bodies are defined with respect to the position of the other bodies, not with respect to absolute space and time. Newton anticipated this criticism, and in his Principia, he described this experiment, which he claims he actually performed in his room in Cambridge. He said he hanged a bucket to his ceiling of his room in Cambridge, and he filled it with water. Then he made the bucket spin rapidly, and when the motion of the bucket was communicated to the water, the surface of the water acquired a hollow, a concave shape. He says that this is a proof of absolute space. He was actually trying also to make fun of Descartes in this passage, because Descartes advocated a dynamics in which only contact interactions between matter, adjacent matter, can have a role, an influence on each other. And here you see that the relative motion of the water with respect to the bucket, when everything is at rest, is zero. And it's zero again when the water is rotating together with the bucket. So it can be the relative motion of the bucket with respect to the water, the cause of the shape of the water. The definitions of absolute space and time that I gave you before are in a scholium of the Principia. A scholium is a margin note that the author writes someplace in a book after the book has been composed. This was at the very beginning of the Principia. And the definitions of absolute space and time are at the beginning of the scholium. The scholium ends in this way. But how we are to obtain the true motions from their causes, effects, and apparent differences, and their converse, shall be explained more at large in the following treatise. For to this end it was that I composed it. So he leaves a problem at the end of the scholium, and he says, I will solve this problem in the book. The problem is to deduce the true motions from the, so the motions in absolute space and time, from the apparent ones, from observables. But it never did it. You read the book and you really can't find a solution to this problem. And what about his successors? For a couple of centuries, the dominant attitude was this. Just ignore the problem, because Newton's system was so successful, so full of good explanations for observations, that nobody really felt the pressure, the urge to find a solution to that problem. And this after, until the end of the 19th century, when Ernst Mach wrote a book called The Science of Mechanics, in which he put these foundational questions again on the table. Mach was an experimentalist. He's known because he's the discoverer of shock waves. And today is most often cited because Mach numbers that are multiples of the speed of sound are named after him, and also a popular line of shaving razors. And so he also wrote this Science of Mechanics. Oops. And he's also known for his principle, Mach's principle. You might have heard this sentence. Unfortunately, he never formulated any principle. In his book, he just analyzed Newton's mechanics, and in particular, the Bucket experiment. And he observed that experimentally, he was a good experimentalist, and he thought about observables, not about philosophical concepts like absolute space. He said, Newton's laws are not verified with respect to absolute space, but with respect to a precise reference frame, which is provided to us chiefly by the fixed stars or distant stars, which have never been observed to move until, well, at this time, I think it was already known, it was already observed in an experiment that lasted like 3,000 years from Aristarchus to, I don't know who, but anyway, the stars provided a reference frame with respect to which to test the laws of Newton, and the rotation of the Earth was a clock with respect to which to test the assumptions about absolute time. He said, in my opinion, no visible effect should have an invisible cause, so we should remove the absolutes, Newton's absolutes, and just give an explanation of the shape of the water in Newton's bucket in terms of the relative motion of the water with respect to the distant stars. This is pretty much Leibniz's view as well. So, in his book, he made this remark, which made a great impression on a lot of people, among which Einstein in particular. He said, no one is competent to say how the experiment would turn out if the sides of the vessel increased in thickness and mass until they were ultimately several leagues thick. So it's clearly that he is advocating some sort of action at a distance of distant and large masses on local matter and local inertial frames in particular. And a lot of people try to implement this in a modified dynamics that could be that could replace Newton's dynamics, and but often, at least before Einstein, all of these attempts were pre-field theory, instantaneous action at a distance model, and they also were typically plagued by predictions like anisotropic masses. So I wait more if I am accelerating in that direction than that. And this is very easy to rule out experimentally. It's very tightly constrained, even at the time. Among these people that tried to give to write a model that incorporates this Mach principle, or whatever you want to call it, there was this Wenzel Hoffmann, who's an Austrian physicist. who wrote a booklet with a model of this sort. But it's most notable because he did something that nobody else did. He wrote about a thought experiment, which he actually thought could be really realized on Earth. He wanted to rule out or distinguish experimentally between Newton's model and Mach's action at a distance of distant masses. He said, we don't have a bucket that is several, we can't make a bucket that is several leagues thick, but we already have one. The Earth is 1,000 and more leagues thick, and it's rotating. It happens to be rotating with respect to the distant stars. So let's try to see what happens to the water in an imaginary bucket. The simplest way is to use a pendulum, like a Foucault pendulum, which traces with a spoke a sign on the ground. And for simplicity, I put it on the North Pole. According to Newton's laws, in an inertial frame, a pendulum will keep moving on the same plane. Its motion will be planar, just like Kepler's orbits. So, according to Newton, this plane is fixed in absolute space, which is the golden standard for inertial frames. And the fact that the Earth is rotating beneath it couldn't have any influence on the motion of the pendulum in Newton's system. So the pendulum should stay fixed, and the Earth should rotate beneath it, and the spoke of the pendulum should, in 24 hours, it should trace a complete circle. But if Mach's idea was right, then there should be an influence of this great mass, this several leagues thick bucket that is the Earth, on the motion of the pendulum, and it should probably drag the plane of the pendulum with it. And so in 24 hours, the pendulum shouldn't have completed a complete circle, but it should lag behind the rotation of the Earth by a tiny amount. How much is should be determined by the relative importance of the Earth's motion with respect to all the Earths of the universe. Now, this can be done. At the time, it wasn't feasible, this sort of experiment, but it actually became feasible just recently, and with the largest pendula that have ever been built, satellites. They are just pendula with a very long rope. And they are planar, their motion is planar. So the satellites LEGEOS and Gravity Probe B, less than a decade ago, finally made this test and ruled out Newton. They found what is now called frame dragging. It's an effect that cannot be explained by Newton's system, and it's actually the prediction of Mach with what regard the bucket. So, as I said, Mach's word made a great impression on Einstein, and they actually were one of the main reasons why Einstein tried to, well, work so hard on general relativity. He wanted to implement Mach's principle. And the problem, as I already said, is that Mach never formulated any principle. He just spoke about this bucket. Somebody else should have formulated it for him. Einstein tried it several times, again and again, and every time he grew dissatisfied with his formulation and he abandoned it. And at the end, he grew frustrated with Mach's principle, and he disowned it. He said, it's irrelevant. Now we have field theory. No action at a distance, instantaneous action at a distance can be implemented in physics. So it's not relevant anymore. We have GR, we are content with that. So the issue was put aside until the 80s of the 20th century, when Julian Barbour and Bruno Bertotti revived the interest on this stuff, because they found they didn't give a good formulation of Mach's principle. They found one in the literature. In 1902, Poincaré wrote an essay, a book called Science and Hypothesis, a wonderful read, and he inadvertently gave a good definition of Mach's principle. It never cited Mach, So that's why, you know, it passed it passed under the radars. He surely would have known about Mark's book, but he probably wasn't thinking about the bucket and this stuff. So Barbour and Bertotti were the first ones to recognize the importance of what Poincaré wrote for Mark's principle. Poincaré asked, what is the problem with Newton? What is the precise defect in Newton's construction that forces him to introduce something so unpleasant as absolute space? And the short answer is angular momentum. So the thing is, you can't measure the angular momentum of the universe if you only have access to observables, which are relative distances between objects. You can't measure the total angular momentum. I can give you a simple example here. This is a popular ride in fairy grounds where people sit on a chair, they're chained on a giant flywheel, which spins them around and lifts them from the ground. If I give you only, if I imagine that the only observables are the position of those people on the ride, and I give you their relative, the observables are their relative separations, their distances, RAB, and their time derivatives, so their change in time. And you can't calculate the total angular momentum. You have to make reference to some background. And in fact, you couldn't predict the future evolution of this system with the only observable initial data. I can give you initial data in which all the RAB over DT are zero. So they might be rotating rigidly or they might be standing still. And then, depending on how much angular momentum you give to the system, the future evolution changes drastically. If you give it zero angular momentum, these people would fall just to be smashed on the pole. Otherwise, they would keep their altitude. So it's not predictive. Observable data is not predictive enough. So let me give you another example. Say that you're an astronomer, and you're given two pictures of three stars. You're not told, where the telescope was when they took these pictures and its orientation. You just know that they have been taken at a distance of, say, a month. And you have to to predict the future evolution of the system. If you have no background with respect to which you can define what is called equilocality, you can do it. So you would like to superpose the two Polaroids on top of each other and make it so that the same point on the two pictures has moved only inertially. In that case, you have determined an inertial frame of reference and you can apply Newton's laws. But if there is no background, if there are no background stars which you can superpose, you can do it. Whatever position of the two Polaroids would be okay. And you can put them in a situation in which you are giving a lot of angular momentum to the stars and they will fly apart in the future evolution. Or if they give you give no angular momentum to them, they will fall on top of each other. So it's quite radical. Usually in physics, we have backgrounds. We study subsystems of the universe and we can compare everything to some background, some distant large masses that are not moving a lot. And we can determine an inertial frame of reference with good accuracy. But what if the system you're studying is the whole universe? You have no such a thing. By definition, there's no background. So equilocality is, what does it mean to be at the same place at different times? It makes sense to say I'm at the same place on Earth at different times, but not in empty space. That is the problem that prevents you from predicting the future evolution of this system. So Barbour and Bertotti took the Poincaré's writings and they cooked it up into a new formulation of Mark's principle. We will refer to it from now on as Poincaré's principle. The dynamics should be such that observable initial data and their first derivatives or their change alone should uniquely determine the evolution. Now, of course, here there is an issue. Clearly, a lot depends on what you believe is observable and what is not. For example, I give you the same physical situation, three stars, three bodies, whatever, and you can describe them in different ways. according to which things you believe are observables. Newton would say their three n Cartesian coordinates, which are for three bodies are nine coordinates, are observables, all of them, because they are referring to absolute space, not time. And they are basically the distances, the three distances of each particle from three fixed planes, orthogonal planes, which can be actually put in whatever orientation and position you want. They are kind of arbitrary. Now, if you believe that the orientation and position of this axis is irrelevant, you would consider as observables just the interparticle separations, the RIAB that I spoke before. So there are these three distances here. There are three for three bodies. And there are n times n minus 1 halves for n bodies. Now, these are less than these, but just because we are considering three bodies, if you go to large n, the interparticle separations grow a lot. They grow quadratically, while the Cartesian coordinates just linearly. So actually, Cartesian coordinates are a great data compression with respect to all the interparticle separations. This is because space, Euclidean space is three-dimensional. If it was n-dimensional, there would be the situation would always be the same, this. Then finally, one is justified to consider only ratios of lengths as observables, because every measurement is always a comparison. I can't say that something has a length. I can only say that it has its length is some multiple of the length of another object. And they actually also have to be on top of each other to say that. So I might consider only the ratios between the separations, and there are two independent ratios. For example, in this case, for three bodies, I could consider the two internal angles that define the triangle. The size of the triangle might not be observable. If I doubled all the distances of the universe overnight, nobody could tell the difference. So I can associate configuration spaces to these three philosophies, these three points of view. If I'm with Newton and I believe that all the Cartesian coordinates are physical, I have Qn, the 3n dimensional configuration space of Cartesian coordinates. If I want just to, if I want to eliminate this arbitrariness in the orientation and position of the reference frame, I have to quotient this space by the Euclidean group of rotations and translations. This is a six-dimensional group, so I end up with a 3n minus six-dimensional configuration space, which I call relative configuration space, QR. Then if I believe that the only ratios are important, I have to quotient Qn by the similarity group, which adds rescalings, scale transformations, to rotations and translations. This is seven-dimensional, so the space I end up with is 3n minus seven-dimensional, called S, shape space. Now, Barbour and Bertotti tried to build up a dynamics out of, first of all, the relative configuration space. So let's see how they solve the astronomer's dilemma. They say, I put the two pictures on top of each other in a random way. Then I measure the Cartesian, I build up this vector, dRa, which is the Cartesian variation of the coordinates of the two of the stars. It's a 3n dimensional vector. Then I exploit this arbitrariness intrinsic in the ability to move the other picture with respect to the first one, and I move Ra. R prime is the second picture, Ra is the first picture, and I move it with the Euclidean group. So this is an infinitesimal translation and an infinitesimal rotation. And I move it however I want. With this, I form this delta RA, which is a combination of the original variation in the coordinates and the variation due to the change in the reference frame. I want to form a scalar quantity with this, I'll show you why. So the simplest one is the Euclidean norm, the 3n dimensional Euclidean norm of a 3n dimensional vector. So scalar product by itself, A is the particle label, and the square root gives you a length. Now, Barbara Bertotti say, I want to find the so-called best matched position of the two pictures, and they define it as the delta RA, so the separation, such that it minimizes L, only taking the variation with respect to dA and d omega, these infinitesimal translations and rotation. So this is independent of the play, of your arbitrariness. You're finding a minimum, and that is it. It's uniquely determined. You remove the arbitrariness. Now, they say the delta best matched is a measure of the intrinsic change in the configuration of the three stars or whatever system you're talking about. So the change that is not due to an invisible and impossible to measure motion in absolute space. Of course, by itself, it's not very good to do dynamics. You want to weight it. For example, you don't. If you have a system of three stars and an atom, you don't want that moving the atom will change L, your measure of intrinsic change, as much as you it would change by moving the star. So you want to weight it with the weight of the particle, of course, with the mass of the particle. And possibly also all the configurations as well might not be all identical to you. And you might want to weight with a function of only the relative configuration space, QR, this intrinsic change. A good choice is basically the Newtonian potential energy. This gives you more weight to the configuration in which two particles are close to each other and near a collision. So I haven't mentioned time as yet. What about time? Barbara and Bertotti found again in Mach, an interesting sentence about the nature of time that made a great impression on them. Still in the science of mechanics, Mach gives us this quite strong opinion about what is time. He says, time doesn't exist, basically. he said, it is utterly beyond our power to measure the change of things by time. Quite the contrary, time is an abstraction at which we arrive by means of the change of things. He says time doesn't exist by itself. It's not a dimension like the three dimensions of Euclidean space. Not that it was an issue that worried him at the time because special relativity wasn't discovered. And time is an abstraction. So there is only change. So when I say an hour passed, I'm just saying that the Earth did 1/24th of rotation. Well, since a few revolutions of the sun, of the Earth around the Sun, we would more say something like an electronic oscillator did some thousands of billions of oscillations, being in tune with some hyperfine transition of a cesium atom. But it doesn't matter. The concept is the same. It's change. So Barbara and Bertotti wanted to implement this idea. And the way they found was geometry, basically. A geodesic principle does the trick. If you have a manifold and you have a metric on the manifold, you're able to calculate lengths. And you might define a curve only intrinsically, given the geometric property of the manifold, by a variational principle like this. You're asking that the curve minimizes the length between a point and another. So this thing is a geodesic principle. You say that it is it gives you a curve that is reparametrization invariant. So the action here, the variational principle is reparametrization invariant. It means that if I parameterize the curve with the parameter lambda, I can change the parameter taking lambda prime, any monotonic function of lambda, and the action will look the same, will depend the same way on d lambda. You see it because it's there is a square root, so it's homogeneous of degree zero in d lambda. Reparametrization invariance is just basically taking a path and changing the arrangement of the milestones of this path, of this street, road, whatever, and without changing their order. It doesn't change the path. It's a geometric intrinsic concept. So Barbara Bertotti said, let's define our dynamical curve as a geodesic principle on our configuration space of observable data. Of course, now, I think I skipped a slide because I didn't give you the final form of the Poincaré principle, did I? Anyway, so the Poincaré principle, but it's just a statement, so it's here. I don't have to write any equation. At first, the Poincaré principle that they came up at the beginning was this: a point and a tangent vector in observable configuration space should determine uniquely the evolution. Now, given that you want to interpret time as change, and you want a geodesic principle in configuration space, the fact is that geodesics kind of implement this principle, but not exactly. They don't depend on a tangent vector. You can give a point and a direction in your space, and then this fixes a geodesic. Because of reparametrization invariance, it doesn't matter the length of the tangent vector that you're taking. The geodesic will always be the same. So we have to distinguish between two forms of the Poincaré principle: a stronger form in which only a direction fixes your future evolution, and a weaker form in which a full tangent vector. There is one degree of freedom of difference, the length of the tangent vector. And this guy here is kind of, it looks a bit at odds with quantum mechanics, because you would have a node phase space or something like that. You have n degrees of freedom in your configuration space, and then the space of directions, which is not n dimensional, but it's n minus one dimensional. So this is something to keep in mind. Now, I showed you before that measure of intrinsic change that Barbara and Bertotti came up with, so the best matched length or line element. And now it provides exactly a geodesic principle on configuration space, basically, because here it is. If you take delta RA and you divide, this is that variation which includes the change of your reference frame, and you divide it by d lambda, where lambda is some parameterization of your trajectory in configuration space, then you integrate by d lambda and you have something that is homogeneous of degree zero in d lambda, so it's reparameterization invariant. Let's take this as our action that defines our dynamics. And let's try to minimize this, so best match all over the curve. It is a two-stage process, because you want, on one side, to minimize with respect to A and omega. Here, the dot refers to the division by the lambda of D. You want to minimize by A and omega to find the best match position. And then you want to minimize the result, which is a best matched action. But you can do everything together at the same time. And the cleanest way to do it is to start to go to the Hamiltonian picture, actually. You define the momenta as the variation of the Lagrangian, now it's a Lagrangian, this L, with respect to R dot, the lambda derivative of R. And it's this complicated expression. But you observe that these are the velocities, and they are underdetermined by the momenta, because this thing is constrained. They can take whatever value they want. They have to satisfy this algebraic equation. It comes out of the square root form of the action. You take the square of p, the square of this cancels with this. You would need an m here, I did it wrong. And then you will end up with a nu. So the square of p is basically u. This is what Dirac calls a first primary constraint. I call it H, because it's basically the Hamiltonian of the system. But it's a vanishing Hamiltonian. This is connected to the square root form of the action and reparametrization invariance. The equations of motion would be just Hamilton's equation with H as your Hamiltonian. And in this sense, they're not different from Newton's equations. What is different from the Newtonian system is that you have to best match. So you have to take, so here you express everything in terms of P and Q, and the A's and omega don't appear anymore. Then you have to take the variation of L with respect to A dot and omega dot to best match. It's not because you had to take the variation with respect to dA. It's really a lambda derivative of the reference system, of the translation and rotation of the reference system. Yes? No, because, no, P squared minus U is here, P squared minus U is zero. So P squared is equal to U. You see, you take the square of this, you remove the square root, here you have dr squared. It cancels with the denominator, and it's equal to u. Sure. It's E, total energy, minus the Newtonian potential. Yeah, that's the computer. So what I was trying to say, yeah. To best match now, you have to impose these two constraints. You can take arbitrary time-dependent translation, rigid translations and rotations of the system, and you're basically gauging the theory with respect to these transformations. What you get is, if you do the calculation, is this, the sum of the momenta, so the total momentum, linear momentum is zero, and the total angular momentum is zero. So this is what Mach's principle in the Barber-Bertotti construction amounts to, a constraint. The total linear and angular momentum of the universe has to vanish for you to be in an inertial reference frame. So you don't have to fix that under determination of the system that Newton had, that was the total angular momentum of the universe. It's just the theory tells you that it has to be zero. Of course, this doesn't mean that angular momentum or momentum don't exist. Subsystems can have it as long as it's compensated by an equal and opposite angular momentum of the rest of the universe. This is how this theory solves the, well, predicts Hoffman's frame dragging of the pendulum. The pendulum moves according to these laws, which are Newton, in an inertial frame. And the inertial frame is that in which the angular momentum of the universe is zero. So if the Earth is rotating, it has angular momentum. And therefore, the system that is attached to the fixed stars can't be inertial, because the fixed stars are all the rest of the universe. They will have an equal and opposite angular momentum. Of course, they weigh much more, so their rotation will be very slow. So if you want to be in an inertial frame, you're rotating both with respect to the Earth and the distant stars. That's the idea. Of course, this theory itself can't predict anything about the Lagos thing, because you're missing action, it uses Newton's instantaneous action at a distance, so it's not good. You have to use general relativity for that. But still, this is a solution of that bucket or scaling problem. So let's see how this model satisfies Poincaré's principle. You want a point and a tangent vector or direction in relative configuration space. So you have these six constraints. You start with six and position, Cartesian coordinates and momenta, but you have to remove 6 degrees of freedom because of these constraints. Now, these are gauge constraints because they are linear and first class. And this, yes? Sorry? If you have just a bucket in the whole universe. Newton never said that you have just a bucket in the whole universe, but. Sure, so if there was just a bucket, you have. Yeah, if you have just a bucket, and it doesn't make any sense to say that the bucket and the water are all rotating. They have to have zero angular momentum. So if something is rotating, it's the bucket with respect to the water and vice versa. And then that would cause a sort of a concavity. Hoffman's experiment, you mean? No. Mm-hmm. So if there's nothing, yeah, in that case you will have it changes. The water would be flat. But we have the universe and distant stars and the Earth, so you can't realize that. What I'm saying is, if you could remove all of the rest of the universe when you have the bucket and the water spinning, the water would stop being concave. But you can't do that. There is a. Yes. Yes. It's just saying that you have to have a zero total angular momentum. So the angular momentum of the stars has to compensate for the one of the bucket. Of course, the bucket is so light that the stars won't rotate much. You won't be able to tell. Because because of inertial forces, you're saying that the reference frame attached to the water is not inertial. And then, so you have to put yourself in a frame that is rotating slightly. And in that frame, you would see Newton's laws apply, so you see inertial forces appearing. Okay. So here I'm saying that basically, since these are gauge constraints, they have to be gauge fixed. So they are redundancies in your configuration space. You want to get rid of them just to have a well-defined set of differential equations. For example, for the momentum constraint, you might say, I apply this gauge fixing that I'm always in the center of mass coordinates, where the center of mass is at the origin. So you have to apply an equal number of gauge fixings as gauge constraints. So you have 12 constraints. So 6n minus 12 means that you have 2 times the dimensions of QR, the relative configuration space, 3n minus 6. This means that you have a point and a tangent vector in relative configuration space. The weak Poincaré principle is satisfied. Okay, this is a nice theory, but it's less interesting than the actual deal, general relativity, geometry dynamics. What about that? Well, it's surprising how well the very same principle work. First of all, let me tell you about the configuration space that you might take for geometry dynamics. How much time do I have? Okay, let's not talk about this. Let's just say that, Reem, you have a similar structure. The space of 3 metrics, which is 6 dimensional. It has 6 degrees of freedom per point. They describe the geometry of a manifold. But you surely want to quotient it by 3 diffeomorphisms because you don't want coordinate systems to be, you want them to be just a gauge choice. And diffeomorphisms are represented by these vector fields, which have 3 degrees of freedom per point. So you end up with, quotienting by this group, you end up with a superspace, which is was coined by Wheeler in 73. It has 3 degrees of freedom per point. It's the space of Riemannian 3 geometries. If you believe, as before, that only ratios are important, you have to allow for arbitrary rescalings of the metric, which means that you're interested in the angle determining part of the metric, not the length determining part. And this removes 1 degree of freedom, and you end up with shape space. We called it shape space as well. It's 2 degrees of freedom per point. Now, let's try with Riem. And Barbour and Bertotti tried it, and they discovered something that was already known. Was a big disappointment to them because they wanted to find an alternative to general relativity. But they found the Beyerlein-Sharpe-Wheeler formulation of GR. It was already known from the 60s, and it is equivalent of GR. It's not a new theory. Just as before, the theory didn't have different equations of motion than Newton, but just constraints. This theory is just equivalent to GR. The form is the same. It's like a geodesic principle with this kinetic term in which you take the variation that is compensated by an arbitrary change of coordinate system, which is this. You represent diffeomorphisms by the lead derivative of the metric. And then you have, this is the way you saturate your indices, and UG is your potential, which has to be a scalar under diffeomorphisms. And the simplest form is this, the three dimensional Ricci scalar minus a constant that turns out to be the cosmological constant. You calculate the momenta, they're over the term, they're underdetermined, and they satisfy this constraint, which is, just looks like the other. And then best matching with respect to diffeomorphism, you get this constraint that says that the momentum conjugate to the metric is transverse tensor. These two constraints are the curse of everyone that wants to study the canonical approach to quantum gravity, in particular this one, because it's problematic, let's say the least. It's hard to quantize. And in particular, it isn't associated to a gauge, to a redundancy in your description from this point of view. So it shouldn't be treated as a gauge constraint. It shouldn't be gauge fixed in the same way that this constraint is. So the Machian approach suggests a different perspective on this constraint, but maybe we'll talk about that later. So if I have time, I want to mention that this, from this perspective, you never introduce the relativity principle. You just discover something that is equivalent to GR, but never talked about relativity, you know, the constancy of the speed of light, the equivalence of the inertial observers, or even the equivalence principle. But you get it for free. And actually, the theory is so resilient to modification that it allows you to rediscover these things. If a theoretician in the 19th century discovered this theory, he could have done it, he would have found out that any matter field has to propagate with the same speed as the fluctuations of the metric. And the light cone is preserved. He would have discovered special relativity and local Lorentz invariance, because the you know, the set of constraints that I gave you might be incompatible with each other. They are in this matter-free case, but if you add matter, you end up with constraints on what parameters or coupling constants you can have. It's between the Hamiltonian, the quadratic constraint, and the. Yes. The same. It's the Hamiltonian constraint moves you on your parametrized curve, so evolves you. If you're moving out in phase space, if you're moving out of your constraint surface, then you're breaking the symmetry with your time evolution.
But can you, in your language,
mm-hmm. you do introduce a phase space. You can do it without a Hamiltonian approach. It's kind of weird, but it works because you take the lambda derivative of G. You take the two constraints and you try to propagate them, which means that you take the time derivative of this guy and check whether it's still zero. And you find that if C is not one, that guy isn't zero anymore. It evolves to something non-zero. So you violate that constraint through time evolution. But it's odd to, what? Time, lambda derivative. The evolution would violate your constraints if you're not fixing those parameters. It's easier to do it with the Hamiltonian approach, introducing a phase space and Poisson brackets and everything. It's even cleaner. Yes?
So if you part the answer to my question, a little bit quiet.
Sure.
If you part the answer to my question, but I just want to clarify something. The constraint being compatible.
Yes, the Poisson algebra doesn't. Yes, it's not weakly vanishing. All the. Didn't try. It's already quite complicated with Young-Mills fields. Well, they tried to modify this guy, putting higher curvature terms and a bunch of different things, and nothing worked. Of course, there is no proof that you can't modify that in any way that would be consistent. But it's very resilient. It's very hard to. The punchline is, if I was in the 19th century, I would have discovered exactly this because it's the simplest thing, and I would have said, "Oh, look, C is one. Let's check it out with an experiment." That would be very striking. So with vector fields, you discover Maxwell's theory. So again, special relativity and the abelian gauge principle. And if you add an internal index, there is a whole bunch of coefficients that need to be fixed. And they all conspire to close a Lie algebra. So you have gauge theory, Young-Mills theory. Now, does this theory satisfy Poincaré's principle? No, it doesn't. The problem is that you don't have a single Hamiltonian constraint that generates reparametrization in this theory. You have a local Hamiltonian constraint, one per point, per space point. And they don't generate exactly reparametrization in the sense that they did in the particle theory. This thing is associated to refoliation. So in the space-time picture in GR, you have the problem of dynamics in GR is you fix a Cauchy surface, initial and a final Cauchy surface. You fix the metric here. You want to find a curve in Riemann. And this is equivalent to giving a point and a tangent vector at the origin. And you want to check out whether you find a unique curve. But say you do this, you find a curve, then you can apply the Hamiltonian constraint with a smearing, an arbitrary smearing N of X and T, which is called the lapse. And that thing would transform your space-like hypersurfaces, that is, the way you cut space-time, you foliate space-time. For example, from the blue curves to the yellow curves, they're not very visible, but they're here. And this corresponds to another curve in Riemann, which has the same endpoints, but different. It's different from the other. And you have a whole sheaf of those curves, one for each function n of x and t. So the Poincaré principle is not satisfied in this theory. This is asking for something more. This is really warning you that possibly your configuration space wasn't right. Wasn't the physical configuration space of GR. Now, the way forward was given by James York in the 70s. He studied the initial value problem of general relativity, which means try to find solutions to these equations at the initial Cauchy surface. You want to find metrics and conjugate momenta that satisfy these two constraints. He found out that you can find the problem is well posed and you can find a solution if you're specifying just not the whole three metric but the conformal part of the metric plus a single global degree of freedom which is related to the total volume if you have a compact hypersurface or its conjugate momentum which is called often the York time. It's the trace of the momentum integrated over all space. So you fix a conformal three geometry, a conformal class. Its conjugate momentum would be a TT momentum, so 2 degrees of freedom, plus this single number, P and V, if you want. Then you have a unique curve, of course, in shape space, not in Riemann. Now, recently, Barbour and Niello Morocco, Brian Keller, several of his collaborators, suggested that this is calling for a different configuration space of GR, which is shape space, but plus with this puzzling volume added to it, this single number. This is what we call shape dynamics. It's due to the work in the last decade of Julian again, Niello Morocco, Edward Anderson, Brian Foster, Enrique Gomez, Sean Grieb, who was a PhD student here, and Brian Keller and Tim Kozlowski was a postdoc here. And this is a theory which satisfies the weak Poincaré principle, but on shape space cross times, this volume, or if you want, the York time. So if you stick on shape space, you can satisfy the Poincaré principle because specifying a different, basically, momentum conjugate to the volume or time derivative of the volume would give you a different curve in shape space. So you don't have a sheaf of curves, but a one parameter family of curves. If you add V to the configuration space, then you end up with a proper, with a theory satisfying the Poincaré principle. So this is the situation, and was the situation when I got interested in this stuff. And it's very exciting, interesting, because there is this puzzling volume, this puzzling global degree of freedom that you have to add to the theory to make it satisfy your principles. Now, the question we are trying to address in these days is how to interpret this theory. Usually, one would have interpreted it as a theory that is reparametrization invariant on this large shape space plus volume on this configuration space. So it's reparametrization invariant, which means that it satisfies an Hamiltonian constraint, which is a function of the conformal geometry, the TT momenta, the volume, and the and its conjugate momentum, and it's zero. Now, this has the pro that it is reparametrization invariant, so the Poincaré's slogan is satisfied, but this is not very good with quantum mechanics, actually, because there is one thing called the problem of time in quantum mechanics. Where is the chalk? We have no chalk. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So in classical mechanics, you have your configuration space. You have H equals zero. And a geodesic principle, for example, would give you a single curve which minimizes your length or your intrinsic change or whatever. This is, for example, Qn. And this is fine. Here, time can be abstracted from change. You have a unique succession of instants of time. But in quantum mechanics, this transforms into something like this. H equals zero is naively would be quantized in this way. An equation, a time-dependent Schrödinger equation, which fixes a wave function as some profile over configuration space, Qn. And here, it's not clear how you are to find out a time evolution. In quantum mechanics, time is really treated as in Newton's absolute time. You have a time-dependent Schrödinger equation in which which evolves the wave function according to an absolute time a la Newton. But if H is zero, this part doesn't appear and you have no evolution. This is the problem of time in quantum gravity because quantum mechanics, as formulated by Arnovitz Deser-Meissner as an Hamiltonian constraint. So, and also this theory, it has an Hamiltonian constraint generating reparametrization invariance. It's not generating an evolution of a wave function. So maybe there is an alternative, and that's what we are exploring these days. Let's use this volume, this puzzling part of the configuration space that doesn't really fit with the other and doesn't look really observable. If I double the volume of the universe, I probably couldn't tell. Let's use V and P and its conjugate momentum. In particular, let's use P as time, as an internal time. Then the volume would turn out to be the generator of translations in this parameter, so you're Hamiltonian. Then you end up with a theory that is purely on shape space, but which has a physical time and a physical Hamiltonian. And the Hamiltonian might even be time dependent, but this guy would satisfy the weak Poincaré principle, and it has an evolution that can be quantized in basically in the naive way of it has some sort of Newtonian absolute time, again, popping back. But it wasn't put in by hand. It was suggested by the theory. So I find this most interesting and fascinating. It might be that the theory is really wanting us to reintroduce Newton's absolute. And we are in the process of exploring this with Julian and Tim Kozlowski in these days. And another thing I'm working on in these days is an even more radical possibility. Let's try to insist on a theory which is fully conformal invariant, is purely on shape space, and it satisfies a geodesic principle there. So it has a reparametrization constraint. And now let's take it seriously and see what happens upon quantization. So we did this with a toy model, which is like the Newtonian gravitational point particle model, and but which has a scale invariant or covariant potential. Then what happens is that quantum mechanics doesn't like a lot scale invariants. And it often happens that a symmetry that is preserved at the classical level would be broken by quantization. And this is called anomaly. You can't find a measure in your path integral that is invariant under that symmetry. We found out that that is what happened with that theory, whatever it means. A way to interpret this is that the classical scale invariant theory can't be just the classical limit of the original theory. It can be at most a fixed point of a renormalization group flow that itself doesn't preserve scale invariance, as always is always the case, and it ends up at a fixed point where scale invariance is recovered just as an effective symmetry. And this is what Chong's input. We might want to interpret this thing as your time evolution. And this is in an upcoming paper with Julian and Matteo Lostaglio, who did his master thesis on this. And we are in the process of writing a paper, and it's an advanced state. This is another possibility. And it isn't necessarily incompatible with the other thing, because they might be all fit together in a larger picture. So for today, that's all. Thank you.
We take questions from the students first. Any student questions? Okay, so let's open the questions to everybody. Yeah.
So you started by trying to dismiss time and a scale. And I think at the end, you just gave up on all your starting points. Right? Now you have both a scale and time.
Right? Kind of. it's interesting, no? It's well, at least on time, now we are kind of close to, well, renouncing to the max side. Well, what we have is an internal time, as some people addressing the problem of time use. But it's not observable, because in our ontology, it's only shapes that are observable, and the volume of the York time of the whole space-like upper surface is not observable. So I don't know. This is telling us something. We are open to, you know, dismiss.
So I'm just talking about that last statement you have.
The what?
The last statement.
The last statement?
Yes. That the RG flow might be, so RG flow is a scaling with,
yeah,
size, and then of course the time evolution is time, and you wanted to get rid of both of them, a scale and
I guess
time.
They are entangled. They are probably two faces of the same aspect, or something that they go together, really. So you could ask, okay, you have your configuration space contains the volume of the whole universe, yeah, but how do you measure it? You can measure it. If you double it, nothing changes. The answer is time, maybe. You can measure, like, it makes sense to compare the volume of the universe at different times, or there is something that is changing. There is a dimensionless ratio that you can actually have access to, and it's this volume at different times. But then if it's driving
That's not how it works. I mean, how in reality it works is that you have atoms that are fixed in size, so you can compare atoms at redshift of one and today, and you see that universe was half the size, right? So it has to do with quantum mechanics. So
sure.
I mean, I think you're getting there.
Yeah.
But the problem is that, are you like giving up on your principles, Pitcher? Is that the cost you have to pay?
Well, I'm willing to pay to sacrifice any principle for truth, which is not. I don't want to be too dramatic, but it's this.
Silly question, but so you're after a different formulation consistent with certain principles, and once you find it, is the theory different in the sense that if you try to make predictions for things that could be measured, even pretend experiments, not real ones, would there be real differences that could be measured in principle between the two formulations?
I think that this Machian approach doesn't really give a different dynamics. It gives you something like constraints, or in the case of general relativity, it gives you boundary conditions also. It's well, it suggests that a closed universe, a closed time space like upper surface is more natural in this context. So it's probably, I don't expect to find a different theory at the classical level, at least not different dynamical laws, but at the classical level, I expect the theory to go funny with boundary conditions, because, for example, an asymptotically flat space is kind of at odds with Mach's principle. You're really pinning down space-time at infinity and giving a preferred notion of what is rotating and what is not. And this sounds at odds with this principle. Also, black holes, it's very interesting to see. This is what we are discussing these days. What happens with black holes? Or what with the singularity? But really, where the theory might really give us a new perspective is the quantum theory, I think. We have nothing really to compare it with at the quantum level. Actually, that's not true. An effective field theory, general relativity can be considered as an effective field theory, and its first quantum corrections make perfectly sense. So that may be already a test ground for this theory. But the hope is that it gives us a new, some hints for the quantization.
You could compare it with string theory. It gives you graviton scattering amplitudes at high energy.
So, also, we also have a propagator for the graviton in loop quantum gravity, I think. So, not sure how experimentally relevant that is, but yes.
So I have a question following up on the last question and then a comment. The question is, could we view this just as a particular proposal for gauge fixing to be used in constructing the quantum theory?
Yeah, it's CMC gauge, basically. That's what, but this is already used in numerical relativity a lot to generate initial data, so.
But you're saying it might play a more fundamental role in the quantization.
Sorry?
If I understand, you're saying that that particular gauge choice might play a more fundamental role in the quantization.
The thing is, the conformal constraint is linear. It looks just like a gauge constraint, more than the quadratic constraint. In shape dynamics, it is more natural to interpret the quadratic constraint as a gauge fixing of the conformal constraint, of the trace of the momentum, than the opposite. And if there is something interesting is in exploiting this conformal invariance of the theory. So interpreting it as a theory which is fundamentally conformal invariant, but in which has a particular gauge fixing that happens to correspond to GR. But then you want to quantize the conformal invariant theory because it has linear constraints. They're easier. So I don't know if it answers.
I see. So the comment is, before I make the comment, I don't want to say you shouldn't pursue this line, any kind of thing that's motivated by an interesting point of view, I think is worth pursuing. But it seems to me that there was a certain amount of philosophical sleight of hand going into the motivation. Mm-hmm. Because when you go back to the very early discussion of Mach's principle in Poincaré, you take the point of view that what's immediately observable are space-like separations, are spatial distances between points. Now, from the last 100 years, we know that that's not true. There's a lot, you know, to measure distances is a choice of reference frame, and the distances change. There's Lorentz contraction, and so on, and so on. It's a very indirect process that gives spatial distances. So I think it's unfair to say in hindsight now that those are the immediately observable things. Mm-hmm. And when we come to gravity, it seems to me it's even less defendable to say that a spatial metric is what's observable. That has only a very indirect relationship to the kind of things that people do. In fact, I mean, if you were to ask what is the spatial metric of the cosmos right now, you have no idea except through dynamical laws and deduction and hypotheses about the initial conditions. What we observe really, if you like, is something along our past light cone or within our past light cone.
Well, but in a canonical approach, you're always talking about a spatial metric, and I mean, to have to do dynamics with fields, that's really what you want to do, no? Consider.
Well, I'm not making an argument against the mathematics. I'm saying that I think that some of the motivation is very on a kind of shaky physical basis.
Well, I mean, we're just trying a different perspective.
I'm not trying to discourage this, but there's a certain implication that comes across that this is what you would be led to if you tried to stick closer to observable things. Mm-hmm. That's really what I'm questioning.
A comment on that is that also in GR, one usually expects, or at least in the canonical approach to quantum gravity, one usually expects the observables to be different, invariant, and to be states that satisfy the constraint. It's kind of the standard thing to do, right? Also the quadratic constraint. This is a motivation just to explore the possibility that you don't have to, that the physical states are conformal three geometries, or, functions on conformal three geometries, on the space of conformal three geometries. So my perspective is just, let's explore where it leads us to.
Absolutely, fair enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, my question is kind of takes off from the last two, but pushes you in the opposite direction. Barber and Bertotti certainly did expect to get a different theory by imposing these principles, their version of Poincaré and Mach's principle. Mm-hmm. And they were shocked to discover that that general relativity was the consequence of making a field theoretic form of it. And then further, they were able, with collaborators, as you mentioned, to recover special relativity, to recover electromagnetism, to recover Yang-Mills theory and local gauge invariance and so forth. So it's, even though there is no new theory, no new experiment, the consequences of imposing the principles of Mach and Poincaré have been very powerful and successful. So in the last 5 minutes or so of your talk, you say, well, but there's a problem with quantum mechanics and quantum cosmology. So we're going to give up this. This was the first comment. We're going to give up these principles. We're going to give up local scale invariance, give up Poincaré's principle in order to, quote, quantize this theory. But these are theories of cosmology. Why aren't you encouraged, in the meaning of, you know, take courage from the success, to find a different route to quantum phenomenon besides just a brute force quantization of the cosmological theory?
Yeah, we have several different principles that enter this picture, and at times they look at odds with each other, or there's a tension, and we might be tempted to abandon one of those in favor of the other. But I don't think that this diminishes its power, the role that it had to reach to get where you are. Time from Mach's perspective, time does not exist, it's just change. That was a powerful idea, and it leads to a key development in this story. I'm saying, I'm willing to abandon it if the theory really forces it on me, or if it is, it's not like it is easier to quantize it if I abandon it. If I find time here, it will be an explanation of what it is. It won't be, I changed my idea about time, that it doesn't exist. It actually exists, and it is it. No, I think that at the fundamental level, it didn't play the role. It didn't enter as a primary thing.
But wait a minute.
Yes.
Because this is the one thing I wanted also to question. When you say time doesn't exist, what Marx said is that time is not measurable or perceptible apart from as a measure of change. But do you believe that change exists?
What? Sorry?
Does change exist?
Sure.
Then time exists.
Sure. But you're...
No, it's different from a Julian Barber-esque statement in his Quantum Cosmology saying change is really an illusion, time is really an illusion. If you believe that change is not an illusion and really exists, then you believe with Mach that time is real and time exists.
But I often said that your statement that time do exist and Julian's statement that time doesn't exist often coincide. They look like it's well, when you argue for long enough, it looks like you're saying the same thing in an opposite way. Probably, I don't know. Julian before advocated his emergent ephemeris time. You remember there is this notion of time that is a distillation of all the changes in the universe, and with respect to that time, your equation of motions look like Newton's equations. Well, that is a time that exists. So when you're saying that it doesn't exist, it looks a bit at odds with this. Of course, he's referring to an Everett-like interpretation of quantum cosmology. I don't know. I still have to make up my mind about this. I'm open.
Okay, let's close the discussion and thanks to the speaker again.
Thanks.